Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 235 featuring Agent X-Ray. And you're wondering, Agent X-Ray? Is that his name? Well, I mean, I probably has a different name on his birth certificate, but he is very, very well known in the CG world and the visual effects world as Agent X-Ray. And if you want to know why he got that name, well, you're just going to have to listen to the podcast. If you want to know his real name, well, you're just going to have to go to the show notes and find that out as well. But he has been around for a long time. He is one of the earliest employees over at Digital Domain. He's also worked at ICT, which is the Institute of Creative Technology, and we talk about that. Rhythm and Hues, DreamWorks, Sony, Image Movers Digital, and a bunch of other places as well. While during that time there, he was an absolutely incredible person in the computer graphics world. And we talk a great deal about the technology of that time, including a lot of things about color and other interesting things. So this actually gets to be a pretty technical episode, even though it's a little bit about the history of CG. But what he has done since then is now he's actually moved over to the gaming industry. And he's done some really incredible work over at Insomniac Games. He is one of the people responsible for the incredible game that's come out on the PS4, the Spider-Man game, which has been well-renowned for its incredible work, including how you're able to get such a massive amount of data in terms of a huge city into a game engine that works on a console. So we really get into it, and it was really cool to be able to talk to him about that. So thank you so much, X-Ray, for being on the podcast and doing that. But SIGGRAPH is coming up, and just as a reminder, SIGGRAPH is happening right now as this podcast comes out. So if you are one of those people that subscribe to the podcast, listen to them as they come out, and you need a ticket to go to SIGGRAPH to come see our talks, you are in luck, my friend, because it's happening right now. Just go to chaosgroup.com/SIGGRAPH2019. In there, you will find a special code to be able to register and get an exhibit-only pass, which is the minimum that you will need to come see our talks. You'll need that badge, but you can register and get the code to get it for free. And on that chaosgroup.com/SIGGRAPH2019 website, you will also find all the talks we're giving. So we've got a huge series of talks that are happening on July 30th and 31st in room 409A. Really great talks, and it would be really amazing to have you guys there. All right. I will be at SIGGRAPH all week. So if you're around, you know, don't forget to just, you know, text me or email me or whatever. I would love to catch up with you guys. All right. Please enjoy this incredible podcast with Agent X-Ray.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Like some superstar, you know the tops don't look hard. Get with it, the ultimate homeboy car.
Sorry, what was that?
Public Enemy.
Public Enemy, there you go. There you go.
Suckers to the side, I know you hate my 98.
It's good. You got it. See, that's already being recorded.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. That's perfect, X-Ray. All right. So in order to get context for people who are going to listen to this podcast, they're going to have to realize, like, why do you have someone named X-Ray on your podcast? And I know why I want you here. But why would someone have, where did a guy named X-Ray come from, and how did that start? What's your origin story?
Well, I used to fly F-18s with Goose and Maverick down at Miramar. Had some wonderful adventures, showering, flying around.
Okay.
Breaking the sound barrier, things like that. That's a total fabrication.
Okay.
No, a lot of people ask me why X-Ray.
Okay. So my real name is Craig. I make no secret about it.
Right.
Probably worked with people for many years who don't know my real name is Craig. So hello, my real name is Craig.
Yeah.
It started in college.
Okay.
I sent an email invitation out to a kegger to all of my fine geek friends on the UCSCB computer community. Okay. You know who you are. Uh-huh. And I misspelled my own name.
Really?
Well, if you can picture a keyboard.
Let me try that.
Keys are next to the C? So
X is right next to the C.
So it came out like X-Reg.
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 Right.
So by the time the party started, everybody was calling me X-Reg or X-Ray G or some variation of that.
Uh-huh.
After a few beers, just became X-Ray.
Uh-huh.
At the time, I was sort of part of a group called WBL.
Okay.
Which was stood for Weird Blinking Lights.
Uh-huh.
We used to do light shows at raves and stuff around UC Santa Cruz and San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
There were a couple guys, Rocky Mullen and David Van Brink and Steve Lerner, who were part of that group. We kind of thought of ourselves as secret agents.
Got it. Hence, so X-Ray takes a nice little secret agent name to it, right?
Yeah, hence Agent X-Ray.
Agent X-Ray. Nice.
And then when I graduated college, one of my first jobs out of college was working at Digital Domain.
Nice. 1993.
And I think the name Craig must have been really popular for boys born in the early 70s or something.
Uh-huh.
There were like five guys named Craig there.
Okay.
Got it. Nobody had phones on their desks. We had an overhead paging system.
Right.
And so
I know that. I've heard it.
They would page Craig to call 4922.
Right.
And inevitably it wasn't for me.
Right.
So I just said, all right, forget it. I'm only going to answer to X-Ray from now on.
Yep.
And I stayed at Digital Domain for about 7 years.
Uh-huh.
Long enough that it just stuck.
Right. 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 So you were at DD in 93. So that was the beginning.
Yeah.
You must have been one of their first employees.
I don't know what my actual hire number was, but the number on my employee ID once they decided to issue employee IDs was number 20.
20. Got it. Yes. Yeah. Well, I've had Doug Grobel on. I think he was number 2. He's still there.
He is the
longest standing Digital Domain person by far, which is amazing. So what were you doing at DD at the time?
How did college
I mean, like how did they find you, hire you? What's the story? You mentioned when we were at lunch that your family comes from film background and stuff like that, right?
Yeah. So I was always interested in film. Mm-hmm. I went to UC Santa Cruz. I studied film and theater arts.
Right.
I moved back to Los Angeles.
So as a humanist, you were not doing computer science.
No, I was not doing computer science.
Okay.
I guess I could back up a little bit.
Sure.
Always interested in computers and video games since as far back as I can remember.
Right.
And I remember, going to see the movie Tron.
Yeah.
In the theater.
Uh-huh.
And looking at those graphics and going like, my God, that's what I want to do with my life.
Right.
Eventually convincing my parents to get a home computer, an Apple II. And I was really bummed out when I realized I couldn't quite do Tron on my Apple II.
Right.
I didn't have a way of, even though I could generate some images, I didn't have any way of recording them. I couldn't get them on tape. I couldn't play back the images.
Right.
I couldn't get, there was nothing I could do to sort of make film using the computer at the time.
Right.
I had a few abortive attempts throughout my preteens. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I sort of found out about girls, rock and roll, and beer.
Right.
And got less and a little less involved with computers.
Okay.
And, but I still wanted to do film. So by the time I got to college, I started to study film and theater arts, the humanities, literature. I was a techie and stuff in school.
Right.
But one of the things that I ended up getting involved with for live stage production was what is now called projection mapping. Nice. So I was doing a computer-generated stage design for college plays back around 1990, 91.
So you would create graphics that would get projected onto things that make it look like more than what it was?
Yeah.
Simple geometry stuff?
It's very simple, very
simple.
But
still
stuff.
Something that would give enough parallax to your graphics.
Yes.
That's the idea, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
And then what I – and also moving video.
Right.
So what had happened in the intervening time, the I mentioned a fellow named David Van Brink earlier as part of WBL.
Uh-huh.
He had been working as a grad student at Apple Computers.
Okay.
And had floated me a version of QuickTime.
Uh-huh.
And this was the missing piece. This was the thing.
How to put all the images together to make a video.
You could, over time, save images and then play them back on a timeline.
Right.
And then as soon as I saw that, I was like, I was right back into computers.
Right.
So that was like, from there, I learned about nonlinear video editing.
Right.
Video editing with QuickTime files on a timeline. Really early days of that.
Yeah.
And then I learned how to program a bit in something called HyperCard.
Okay.
So I was writing programs to enable stage managers to control video projection maps during live stage plays. At UC Santa Cruz. And the interface for this would basically be what we'd call, HTML today,
okay,
where you'd have the script. So a stagehand could basically follow along with the script.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be a button on the cue line. When they hit the button on the line of dialogue, mm-hmm, it would cue up the appropriate video, spool it to the projector,
right,
and play the video.
So it'd be like this button when they click this, play this video.
Yeah. Then it would also load the next video into RAM.
Right, because it would otherwise...
Because otherwise there'd be a time delay.
Right.
So it would buffer the next cue.
Ah.
And then when the next cue came up and the stagehand was able to press the button, mm-hmm, it would immediately switch to the next video or image cue.
Right.
And mostly I did that because I'm lazy and I didn't want to be the one who had to run that every night.
Yep. So many stories of people who sit around computing. Like, as a friend of mine, for example, he ended up getting some crappy job at a bank just like out of school. And it was literally just data entry job. And he realized, like, I hate this. It's so boring and it's so unnecessary. So he wrote a program to make his job obsolete. And it was the first time he ever programmed. And instead of just because he wanted to quit his job, right? But he felt bad about just leaving. So he did that, and then instead of actually him, quitting, they ended up promoting him.
It's like, yeah, I mean, I just, I was really interested in the technology and the art and the design of these stage productions, but I didn't want to have to sit there every night, pressing a button. So,
Saw a solution that you could try to get to, right?
Yeah. So I wrote a framework for that using, mm-hmm, HyperCard, and then we would get some of the underclassmen to actually, sit there and follow along and press the button at the right time.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. So that was would you consider that your first foray into computer graphics?
No.
Really?
Yeah. There was, going back to the first iteration on that Apple II and Tron.
Uh-huh. Your attempts to try to
recreate my attempts.
That. Yeah.
I actually worked in 1983.
Yeah. Okay.
On a television show called The Fall Guy.
Really?
And I did on-set computer graphics.
Okay. What were you doing in 83 in computer graphics on that show?
So what I was doing was, it was an episode of The Fall Guy called TKO, Technical Knockout.
Okay.
The plot involved a kidnapping attempt and a ransom phone call.
Okay.
On the ransom phone call, there are the sounds of airplanes flying overhead.
Okay.
So the characters in the TV show decide that they wanted to hire a computer hacker to compute the Doppler shift of the sound of the overhead airplanes and correlate that against a database of schedules of flights from airplanes at local airports.
Okay.
So they hired an actor to play this hacker mm-hmm. who had to sit in front of a computer mm-hmm. and pretend as though they were entering data and getting results.
Right.
What I did was I wrote a program in AppleSoft Basic
okay.
that displayed graphics and tables and things, and then just waited for the actor to hit the enter key to do the next thing. Uh-huh. So the actor.
So you wrote a program that would show. Okay.
Not too dissimilar from what I did in college, kind of.
Like, 83.
Yeah, 83.
How old were you at that point?
I was 13.
13? How did you get that job?
My dad was writing for The Fall Guy.
Okay, there you go.
So my dad was a television writer. He was writing for The Fall Guy.
Okay.
And they were going to hire somebody for thousands of dollars to do this.
Like, my son could probably do this on his Apple IIe.
My dad's like, my kid could do this for $500. Why don't we hire him?
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I love that.
Got to go down to the set, meet Lee Majors and Heather Thomas.
Oh, my God. Lee Majors.
Yeah.
Wow.
Marky Post.
That's okay. First of all, I kind of love the fact that you have so much detail about that plot, which is great because that sounds like a pretty good episode. Okay, so I want to get we still have to figure out how you went from doing projection mapping on set in college or in grad school, I guess, right?
Yeah.
To getting a job at Digital Domain.
Okay. So I graduated college, came back to Los Angeles,
yep.
bounced around various production assistant jobs, and I got a lead on a production assistant job at Digital Domain.
Okay.
From the cousin of a friend of mine.
Okay.
Her name was Brooke Breton.
Okay.
She was an executive producer at Digital Domain. She's gone on to executive produce all sorts of great stuff
okay.
since then.
Let's just to be so because some of the listeners may not know what a production is. Like in the LA world, everyone knows what a PA is, but some people may not know what a PA is. A lot of things. Production assistants are really like the lowest person on the totem pole, right?
Yeah.
They're the person that's running around like, I need a cup of coffee. Yes, get the PA to get your cup of coffee. Run me 17 more copies of this script. That's the production
yeah.
assistant.
So I was literally hired for 2 weeks
okay.
to move boxes.
To move boxes. They're the perfect example.
Digital Domain was originally located in a building near Rose and Main called the Antioch Building.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a warehouse building across the parking lot that another company had been in. I think they were, I don't remember the name of the company. And they moved out and Digital Domain was going to take over that space.
Okay. All owned by Google now.
It's all owned by Google now, yeah. So my job was to move boxes from the Antioch building over to the warehouse building.
Okay.
I was hired to do this for 2 weeks. I realized that these boxes contained Macintosh LC3 computers.
Uh-huh.
And I had been doing all of my projection mapping work and all of my computer graphics in college on Macintosh computers. I was familiar with how Macintoshes were networked over AppleTalk
mm-hmm.
Using serial cables, very different from how we do Ethernet today.
Yeah. AppleTalk, oh my God. That
yeah.
does it.
Yeah. So when I realized that these computers these boxes were mostly full of LC3 computers, I offered to set up the computers on everybody's desks and configure the networking.
Okay.
As I did this, mostly for the accounting department, uh-huh. it dawned on them that, I was the only one who knew how their network was configured and they couldn't get rid of me.
There you go.
They actually offered me a job after that as the Macintosh system administrator at Digital Domain.
Okay.
I turned it down.
All right.
I told them what I really wanted to do was visual effects.
Right.
That's why I was there. And they agreed that they'd give me an entry-level visual effects position called a technical assistant.
Yeah.
As long as I would continue to support the AppleTalk network for the accounting department.
How do you split that time?
Until such a time as they would hire a full-time
replacement. Right.
Okay. To take that on. So from being a PA or a production assistant, mm-hmm. Moving boxes on a 2-week contract,
uh-huh.
I became a technical assistant working full-time at Digital Domain. And I spent most of my time learning how to script in C#, and make tar backups onto exabyte tapes.
Yep. Right. So kind of tedious IT work in a sense.
Yeah, which, you know, I quickly developed solutions for scripting away the tedium.
Right, which is exactly what you did in college with the push-to-button solution.
Yeah.
Right.
So we, you know, I did that work for a little while. And then around, gosh, I think it was SIGGRAPH 94, mm-hmm. Orlando, if my, I think it was 94.
Okay.
I think SIGGRAPH 94 was Orlando. Mm-hmm. Most of the company went to SIGGRAPH. Skeleton crew left behind.
Right.
And Stan Winston came into the office one day. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, my God, they've messed up Brad Pitt's makeup on Interview with the Vampire. Somebody took an eyeliner to his face. It's supposed to look like veins, and it looks like scribbles. Uh-huh. Can somebody here please fix it?
Okay.
I said, sure, I'll do it.
Okay.
I had no idea how I was going to do it. I had no idea. Yeah. But I agreed to do it, and I... Between getting a little bit of mentorship and some self-teaching, I learned how to do compositing on a flame.
Okay.
And basically photo retouched all of the scenes in Interview with the Vampire where Christian Slater is interviewing Brad Pitt in the San Francisco hotel, which is sort of the frame story around that movie.
Right.
So, all, so if you remember the movie at all, you know, Brad Pitt's very pale and he's got these veins on his face. So my job was basically to 2D track these veiny mats onto his face to obscure and blur out the color channels individually of the lines that had been drawn onto his face during the live action shoot. And make them, you know, more subtle and less makeup-y, I guess.
Yeah. It's interesting because, like, we still do stuff like this today. Like, on a flame. Literally, that's what my wife does. She works at Photocam. She does beauty work over there, right? So it's like, that sounds exactly like what – and it's like, this is, you know, 25 years ago, and you're still doing this almost exact same process.
Yeah.
So that's kind of amazing. So it's cool. So, okay, so Interview with a Vampire was the first time you sort of like sat down at a computer and like, let's see what I can do?
Yeah.
As far as being an artist in that sense?
Yeah. And then shortly after that, I went to the CEO of the company and I said, hey, you know, I'm doing digital artist work now.
Right.
But you're still paying me like a technical assistant.
Right.
I need a promotion. And he agreed.
Okay, good.
And, you know, I got to give Scott Ross all the props in the world for that.
Nice.
And off I went on my sort of professional career.
Mm-hmm. So what was your next film?
Gosh, after Interview with the Vampire, let's see, what did we have in production? I don't remember if True Lies was before, after, or during.
Okay.
I think it was at the same time.
So you worked on True Lies, right?
Yeah, I did a little bit of work on True Lies.
Yeah. That was one of their first films, I thought.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think their first, if I'm not mistaken, the first thing they did, which I had nothing to do with, was a film called Color of Night with
Bruce
Willis.
Color of Night, yes, yeah.
And they also did an animated logo for Tim Burton's production company.
Okay.
I think those were like some really early digital domain jobs that were going on.
Yeah.
And then I think Apollo 13.
Apollo 13 was shortly after that. After True Lies, I think.
Yeah. So I was the I was in charge of color grading Apollo 13.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice.
So this is back in the day, obviously before digital cinema had taken off.
Yep.
We were still using photochemical solutions.
Color timing is what it's called.
Well, it was color timing for the final print.
Yes.
But what we were doing was we were scanning the negatives using a Cineon system. Mm-hmm. So they were coming in to the computers as 10-bit logarithmic color space files.
In Cineon
format. That's
which is still sometimes used today. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Haven't seen it in a while.
I think most people have completely switched to EXR format, but Cineon was still, you can still see Cineon files every now and then.
But, you know, it's 10-bit logarithmic and computers display everything in 8-bit linear.
Right.
So we had to create.
It was kind of a mini HDR.
Yeah, it's like a mini HDR. It's an extended gamut to try to contain the full gamut of film.
Right.
And the pipeline at the time was basically that you would create a lookup table.
Yes.
To convert the 10-bit log to 8-bit linear.
Right.
And then on the way back out of the computer to the film scanner, you would run the inverse of that lookup table.
So they would look the same.
Yeah, so it would look the same. You'd still lose a bit of information, but ideally, if you create the lookup table correctly, you're preserving as much of the visible information, the important information as possible. Since that's not really a task that we could automate, it requires a person to create the LUT or the lookup table for each individual shot.
So you made a LUT per shot.
A LUT per shot, which, you know, if you think about it in terms of films today where there's 1,500 shots or 2,000 shots.
They actually do sometimes.
That would be a lot of work, but it's funny to think Apollo 13 has 135 shots.
Right. Well, nowadays.
Which was big at the time.
Nowadays, when you do an edit, right? So edits have EDLs, which is an editorial decision list. Now they have something called a CDL, which is color decision list.
Mm.
So every shot is decided as a lookup table in a sense. So it's,
Yeah, but everything's kept in EXR so you don't lose any
information. Oh, yeah, no. You got enough information to last for days.
But also, you know, storage was an issue too.
I
mean, we literally lost bits. We converted the files from 10-bit log to 8-bit linear.
And then you can't go back.
You can't go back.
Right.
You lose information.
Yep.
We would keep that LUT associated with that file set. The compositors and 3D animators would use that 8-bit file as the background image or for the composite. And then once everything was composited and color corrected together in 8-bit space, we would run the inverse of that input LUT to convert it back to Cineon and then print to film.
Right.
So that was the color pipeline for Apollo 13,
and
many other films of the time, That I was.
I think we were still using the same thing on Day After Tomorrow, which wasn't long after that, actually.
Hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely. And it was the thing that I learned, It was, you know, it was my first job in visual effects, and then learning log space and LUTs and gamma, all that stuff. I was like, you mean what? Like I was, it took me, honestly speaking, suddenly, you know, ironically, it's like the light bulb that goes off. And I was like, oh, I get it. Light is linear. Like understanding light is linear, but understanding how much more information is in the darks than that. And so that's why you make a logarithmic curve so you can expose more of the blacks. It all made sense after a while. It all made sense. But it was a really interesting study of color. I did it at DD, so it's interesting. It probably came from you.
Some of that did, yeah. And I was very fortunate to have a really awesome mentor at Digital Domain at the time. It was a fellow named Price Pethel, who is a really old school colorist from the Telecine days. And I think his son runs Company 3 or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's one of the top color guys in Hollywood.
Interesting.
So,
well, it is so important. Another thing that I realized also is a Digital Domain, you know, when I got there and I was, you know, sort of getting to know the company, was so well renowned for its ability to create shots that would transfer through Telecine very well, right? So they had a system, or they still do, where they gauntlet the shot is what they used to call it, right? You probably know what I'm talking about. So when you gauntlet a shot is, you look at it and then you gamma it way up so that you can check. When you're looking at it, you check to make sure all the blacks are matching perfectly, et cetera. What often happens, just people will be familiar with this, what often happens is someone will create some visual effect or some kind of optical print, right?
Optical print.
So when they would optical print stuff, right? It would look great in a movie theater, but then when they transfer it to TV, which is
a different gamma
Which is a different gamma space, which is also known as Telecine, the process would be called telecine. It goes from, you know, cinema to television. The blacks would be off. And so what often happens when you look at it on your TV is like, whoa, why is the obvious, the spaceship looks like a cutout and it's a dark black and then everything else looks a little blue or something else. That's because the blacks never matched, right? Mm. But digital domain, they would make it look good on film, but then they would gamma it way up to just make sure like those blacks matched.
Yeah.
So the visual effects at DD in the, you know, the 90s and the early 2000s were perfect for the telecine. And that was a that was an important part of that learning curve.
Always match the shadows. You always got to
the shadows.
Find the darkest thing in there and make that your black point, and make sure that all the blacks from all of the elements match that shadow color.
Yeah, and we have to go in there and just check, you know, like you know, and just go red, green, blue channel because sometimes the shadows are a little cooler than you think they are, and you don't realize. So check red, green, blue, and make sure they're always connected. So. It was a very important learning.
We didn't call it gauntleting when I was there, but we did the exact, that's exactly what we were doing.
That, I think they call it a gauntlet. It's like, it's done. It's gone. Because there were so many times where I remember the director would say, the shot's final. And we're like, great. And then, but it was still not final to DD themselves. They were like, no, we're going to have to gauntlet this shot and check it because we, while it looked good in the screening room on film, we want to make sure it looks good on TV as well. So.
Yeah.
It was a good learning curve. I learned a lot from that process. Anyway, so you were at DD for a while, and then at some point you moved over to Sony.
Yeah, so I left Digital Domain, went to Sony for a little bit, and worked on Hollow Man.
Hollow Man. That's an important film. That must have been tough. That was a big endeavor at Sony at the time.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was a very difficult production on a number of levels.
Yeah.
I didn't stay at Sony after that.
Okay. What were you doing on Hollow Man?
On Hollow Man, I was doing visual effects in Houdini. And let's see, it was primarily things like they had a volumetric solution for rendering the veins of the characters as they would appear and disappear.
Yeah.
So I was generating the data for those volumetric renders.
Interesting.
I remember animating electrodes and wires that were attached to an invisible person. So they had to, you know, move and react as if they were, you know, on a character. Mm-hmm. And also I remember animating and rendering lighting a bed. Like a hospital bed that had an invisible person lying.
So you have
in
to have indentation and the motion.
Indentations, wrinkles, all the motion. Yeah. So I remember waking up really early in the morning, doing the commute over the 405 to Sony, getting in the office and then having to look at a bed all day.
Right. Yeah. I remember Hollow Man was a big show at ImageWorks, and it was a difficult one. I know it was very difficult. I went there for Ghost Rider.
Mm.
I enjoyed ImageWorks, honestly, but on a personal level, I think it was such a clash from DD, because DD was always like the crazy frat house thing where you could do anything. And then you'd go to Sony, which was wonderful and corporate, but very corporate and very straight-laced. So everything was like the fact that like my keyboard was acting funky. And they said, here's a catalog, buy whatever keyboard you want and whatever you want, we'll get it for you. My chair, they were like, they brought in an ergonomic specialist to check my chair and got me whatever chair I wanted to sit in. And I was like, this place is amazing. But at the same time, I think I was a little bit, I still liked the romance of the gung-ho attitude that I had.
Yeah, I mean, Sony was a great company, but you know, at the end of Hollow Man, it was such a hard show, and by that I mean just putting in the hours to get it done.
Yep.
I felt like I was a little burned out at the end of that,
sure.
And so I needed a change.
Yeah, I hear you. So where did you end up after that?
Let's see. After that, I actually went to work at the Institute for Creative Technologies.
Oh, ICT.
Yeah. ICT in the graphics lab with Paul Debevec.
Oh, so that's how far back you know Paul. Wow.
Yeah, I met Paul when he did the Campanile film.
Right.
Actually, I met him down the street at Smashbox Studios.
Really?
Yeah, he was, I met him at a party that Wired was hosting.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So you go way back with Paul like this. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so I was friends with him, and then he got the job at ICT, and he brought me in as a consultant.
Right.
And I worked with him in his graphics lab for a while, and I was doing a bit of installation art for the office as well.
Okay.
Various projections and things around the office.
So building. Were you working there during, what was the, when he was doing the Parthenon stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. Because that's the first time I met Paul was during the Parthenon stuff. I went there. Interesting.
Yeah, that was, right around 2000, 2001. Yeah, that was when I worked
okay.
at the Institute for Creative Technologies.
Well, that's awesome. Okay. So how long did you work there for? A couple of years? A
couple of years. All right. Yeah, I worked there for about 2 years, worked a bit on the Parthenon project, worked on a few other initiatives that they had going there.
It was the light kind stage of a, was starting.
It's lights, a, yeah, yeah, light stage was starting up. I remember bringing in some guys, Ivan DeWolf and Greg Ercolano, to help out with some early iterations of the light stage.
Yep.
We're working with Marcos Fajardo over there.
Yeah, yeah, well. Arnold guy.
Yeah, Arnold guy.
Now, he's a nice guy. I love Marcos. I work with Marcos at Sony.
Yeah.
So he had just started at Sony, and they were going to use Arnold for Monster House, and he was working hard on Monster House. At that point, Arnold was not its own product. It was actually owned by Sony at the time. So, yeah, I used to speak to him about ray tracing all the time.
Well, when I met Marcos, Arnold was a plug-in for 3D Studio Max.
Yes.
It was not its own executable.
Nope.
And I remember having a conversation with him where I explained that if he wanted it to be a full-fledged production renderer,
it needs to
be standalone, and it needs to read a scene description file.
Right. Which nowadays is, I guess, mostly. But honestly, V-Ray wasn't that way for a while. It took a long time for V-Ray to find a need to really do that, right? Because it's only the visual effects studios that wanted that.
Sure.
Right? The other places didn't feel a need to do that. They'll just render it right inside the application, right?
Sure. But if you have, a render farm and...
Absolutely.
I
get it. And you don't want to fire up a license.
You don't fire up a license for Maya or 3D Max.
Max was free rendering.
Yeah, as long as you used Afterburner on Windows.
Yes.
Not Linux.
Right. Yes.
Or SGI.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. But yeah, it was very interesting. You're right. I think Pepe Land was one of the big things that he did on there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I worked with Marcos on the ASS file.
Really?
Yeah.
The ASS file.
The first ASS file.
Nice. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
We were having discussions trying to figure out what to name it. Mm-hmm. There were a few options.
ASS.
ASS1.
Right. ASS1. Okay. I had this conversation with Aaron Sims because his company is Aaron Sims Creative. They were going to call it Aaron Sims Studio, but then for the same reason, they didn't. So it's like, that's not going to work. It was pretty funny. Anyway, yeah. Okay. So you created the ASS file.
Yeah.
So you're the ASS man.
I'm the ASS man.
Such a Seinfeld reference. That's awesome. Well, that's cool. Okay. All right, so that was scene description files, right?
Yep.
At that time,
yep.
Right? And then this was at ICT.
That was at ICT.
Okay.
So that was the first version of Kick was written at ICT. So we would kick the ASS files.
Kick. Now it all makes sense. Okay. All right. And I believe you guys were using Arnold for the Parthenon project too,
yes.
Right? For the renderings, right?
Yes.
Got it.
And so that was part of that whole pipeline.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Awesome.
Because again, we wanted to be able to run Arnold outside of 3D Studio Max. So
right. Yeah. Okay, so excuse me. At that time, was Arnold still owned by Sony, or was he independent at that point?
No, Marcos was totally independent.
He was always kind of independent.
And Sony had nothing to do with Arnold at that time.
Okay.
And I don't know what the business arrangement was. I can't speak to really what that was.
I don't really know. I don't want to get into the details about it, but I do know that Sony owns their version of Arnold and he owns his version of Arnold, and they don't pollute the waters.
There was some kind of co-development that happened.
Absolutely.
And it was a business arrangement. Yep. And I'm not really privy to the details.
Right. So at this point, he's no longer at Sony, but he's got his version of Arnold, and he can do whatever he wants with it.
This was long before that.
This was before that. It wasn't a commercial product when he was working on ICT.
It was not.
Right. Right. Got it. Okay. All right. Well, there you go. So you you created the ASCII files, and you were able to render an Arnold independently, and that's what you used at ICT.
Yeah, now it gives me just a little bit of a chuckle every time I watch an Academy Award-winning film to imagine that there's a back room somewhere with a bunch of technical directors talking about what to do with all these big ass files.
That's good. That's good. I like it. Yep. Okay. So where do you go from there? Where's our next steps here on your journey?
Oh, geez. Let's see. The next step after that was I went to CineSite for a little while.
Okay.
Worked on X-Men 2.
Okay.
And Freddy versus Jason.
A little horror stuff.
Okay. Horror.
Yeah.
That place shut down.
Yes,
they
it
got
did.
Shut down.
It was during a Roland Emmerich film of some kind. What was it? Was it Day After Tomorrow? No.
No.
Wasn't – no. Oh, I'm thinking of something else. Never mind. Okay. So that place did shut down. I remember specifically.
Yep. They shut down. I went into education for a little while after that, teaching.
Okay. Where are you teaching?
I was teaching at a school called the Digital Hollywood Institute of Media Arts.
Okay. All right. So in Hollywood, I'm assuming.
Well, they were actually in Santa Monica on the 3rd Street Promenade.
Okay.
They were the Los Angeles office of a Japanese computer graphics school.
Ooh, okay. Got it.
So I was there for about 2.5 years, mm-hmm. Running the school.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
That was really great. Met a lot of really great people.
Okay.
From there, I went to a company called A52.
Oh, of course I know A52.
I worked at A52 for a while.
Okay.
Worked with some guys like Wesley Sorokin, who's now like the head of 2D for Mill in New York.
Yeah.
Jeff Ouellette, who's I think over at Timber now.
Okay.
And Dennis Gautier, who's a really brilliant Houdini renderman.
Right.
Guy.
We work with a guy a lot. I'm very close with Kurt Shintani. I don't know if you know him.
Yeah.
So he's pretty cool. They it's interesting, the A52 guys, because the first show they ever did with V-Ray was the season one of the title sequence for Game of Thrones, right? So the title sequence of that. And so they just finished the last season, obviously, just finished. And they did something completely different on that last season, or it was evolutionary, but to them, they just rebuilt it from scratch. And so to them, there was like this journey of like their V-Ray of the last 10 years of using it, that company.
Yeah, that's incredible work. I mean, I'm big fan of the show.
But they're also a really creative place. A52, Elastic, really, really amazing creativity coming out of there.
Yeah. Amazing just the editorial skill, the design skill.
Right.
3D, I mean, everything, soup to nuts, top to bottom.
Yeah.
Very vertically integrated. I remember we were working a lot at the time with David Fincher.
Uh-huh.
I think he was doing the movie about the serial killer.
Oh, Zodiac.
Zodiac. So Zodiac was in production. And that was one of the very early kind of all digital productions.
Yes. He shot him on Viper cameras, I think.
Yeah. So there was a lot of just kind of inventing a color pipeline, an end-to-end color management and editorial pipeline. So in addition to the creativity that was happening at A52, there were like exceptional technical chops as well, sort of groundbreaking stuff.
Yep. Yeah. Really cool. Well, that's pretty awesome. So how long – you were at A52 for a few years?
A52 for a few years.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to DreamWorks.
Oh, okay.
DreamWorks Animation.
Yeah.
I was DreamWorks Animation for a few years.
Okay.
I was the crowd supervisor on a film called B-Movie.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Seinfeld.
Seinfeld.
Yeah.
Contributed some effects to the first Kung Fu Panda movie as well.
Oh, nice.
And I remember, you know, at the time, you know, DreamWorks had had inherited the PDI pipeline.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which was, you know, a little bit... It was difficult for me at first. There's a pretty steep learning curve. A lot of legacy, pretty steep learning curve.
Uh-huh.
And I remember when I had the chance to get a job after that at Image Movers Digital. I left DreamWorks, went to Image Movers Digital. And I remember thinking, like, you know, I had so many problems with the DreamWorks pipeline.
Yes.
That I want to be the guy who in 10 years, somebody new is criticizing for the decisions they made when they invented the pipeline.
Right.
So Image Movers was my chance to do that.
Okay.
My plan was I was going to go to Image Movers, which is a brand new studio.
Uh-huh.
I was going to help build the pipeline.
Yes.
And I was going to make all the decisions that in 10 years, somebody else would be really frustrated
like,
with.
Why is this like this?
Yeah. And while doing that, I realized why
Zemeckis
a lot of,
was part of the IMD, right?
Yes, it was Zemeckis' animation studio.
Right.
But a big revelation as part of that process was that I was making a lot of the exact same decisions that the people at DreamWorks had made.
You realize, like, this is how they ended up with those
and
decisions.
I realized, you know, wow, these were not bad decisions.
Right.
This is why they made the decisions they made.
Right.
But it wasn't until I had an opportunity to build something new from the ground up that I realized why they did things the way they did.
Yeah. It's amazing how that happens. Yeah. It's really cool. Okay. So you helped build IMD, right?
I did. And that studio met an unfortunate demise.
Yeah.
And so I moved back to Los Angeles.
Yeah, because that was in the Bay Area, right?
That was in the Bay Area. Okay. So I moved to the Bay Area for a few years.
Uh-huh.
Then I moved back to Los Angeles in, I guess that was around 2010.
Yep.
And got a job working at Rhythm and Hughes.
Nice.
So I was working at Rhythm and Hughes in the technical art department, I guess.
Okay.
I wasn't assigned to specific shows. I was writing visual effects tools to be used across all shows.
Okay.
Not quite pipeline, but, you know, visual effects generation tools, Houdini digital assets, things like that.
Technical directory kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Got it.
And that was actually my second stint at Rhythm and Hughes. I sort of skipped over. Immediately after ICT, I also had done a stint at Rhythm and Hughes in 2001.
Okay.
Where I worked on Some of All Fears.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Using the Jig volumetric renderer.
Wow.
For the atomic explosion that happens in that film.
Okay.
Jig, I think, is long gone.
All right.
Sort of bouncing around here a bit.
That's okay.
So I went to Rhythm and Hughes, and then Rhythm and Hughes shut down.
Now, okay, I know it's a sad story, and we'll get to that. But didn't Rhythm and Hughes have right? They wrote their own software, right?
Yes.
So they had like their own compositor, their own modeler, and their own lighter, right? And didn't they call it Rhythm and Hughes?
Yes, Rhythm and Hughes.
So each of those things, like there was a software called Rhythm, another one called And, another one called Hughes. I thought so.
I remember the compositor was called Icy.
Icy, that's right. I never was there, but I remember hearing all these stories.
Yeah, there was Icy. They had a rigging software.
Mm-hmm.
They had a renderer called Ren.
Yep.
One
Which
of the
was
guys,
very good at Fur.
Yeah, no, yeah, it was a good renderer.
Mm-hmm.
I think by the time that I was there, they were still using Ren for a lot of the character work.
Right.
But for environments
they and
things.
To RenderMan at that point?
No, we were using Mantra.
Oh, Mantra. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, we the most of the so by 2010,
uh-huh.
most of the effects and environment stuff and the volumetrics
yep.
were being done in Mantra at Rhythm and Hughes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So do you stay at R&H till the end?
Yeah, I was at R&H pretty much until the end.
Wow.
And from there, I went to a company called Murata.
I I've heard of them.
Murata is a small commercials.
Oh wait, they did
creative agency.
Didn't they? Didn't Murata? They did Pac Rim.
We did the we did the opening shot.
Wasn't it? Wasn't Pac it one Rim. Of what's his name's? Wasn't it owned by the guy who directed Pac Rim?
So Guillermo del Toro yes. had an interest in the
Murata.
Company. He
okay.
was one of the founders.
Yeah.
I don't really know all the details of what that arrangement was.
Right, right, right.
But yeah, so Murata worked on Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
The first couple.
They were in Marina Del Rey.
Yeah, Marina Del Rey.
Yeah.
Actually, interestingly, so Murata was in the building that had previously been Boss Films.
Oh my God. Yes. Okay.
And before it was Boss Films, it was EEG.
Okay.
Which was Douglas Trumbull's studio.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. All right.
So, and before that it was a 7-Up bottling plant.
Okay.
So,
there you go. So that's some history.
So it was a building that had some history.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that was EEG was where Trumbull, I believe, where he invented ShowScan.
Wow.
It's where some of the Star Trek the Motion Picture stuff was done.
Yep.
Where probably Brainstorm was probably
right,
worked
right.
on there. When Boss moved in, I think they, you know, that's where like Blade Runner was shot.
Yeah.
Or was Blade Runner Boss or was that? That was Trumbull.
Was.
That was.
No.
That might have been EEG.
Maybe.
I'm just pulling this off the top of my head, so
Boss,
it's a little fuzzy.
Well, so Boss was
Richard Edlund.
Richard Edlund. Who else was there? Mark Stetson was there too, I think.
Mm.
It's a bunch of those old guys. I want to say call them old guys.
Anyway, I know that Blade Runner was right. whether it was EEG or Boss. Blade Runner right. was probably shot on the stage there.
Yeah, yep.
Some of those shots of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. A lot of miniature stuff.
A lot of miniature stuff. So yeah. that building had a long history, and mm-hmm. So Murata was in that same building.
Nice.
And I was privileged to work there.
Yeah.
That was a good few years with a really good crew working on a lot of commercials.
Nice.
A lot of great stuff. From there, I went. Literally across the street into the building that was Boss Digital, which is another production company called Logan.
Yeah, okay. Yes, yes.
So I worked as a digital effects supervisor at Logan for a number of years, helped build out their pipeline.
Yeah.
And then I left Logan for Insomniac Games.
Right. So you made a transition to video games at that point.
Yeah.
You had done what a lot of people, you had bounced around from place to place. You'd gone from project to project, done a bunch of stuff. A lot of times people realize like, wow, I can't believe you changed the company so many times. This is not unusual. A lot of times you move around from project to project more than you have any loyalty to a specific company at this point, right?
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, I would have liked to have had more stability, but you know, it is what it is.
Well, do you, because like if you're working in production, let's say you're working on a camera team, or you know, you're an assistant camera director or whatever it is, right? I mean, you're going to be moving around from movie to movie, right? So
you, yeah. Well, that brings up a whole other topic, which is unionization.
I know,
because part of stability are things like benefits and health insurance,
which we don't have.
Which, if you are in visual effects, you probably don't have unless
right.
you're a staff at a company.
Right.
But as a camera person working on a union production,
you are a part of a union.
You're part of a union, right. and you have health insurance. In between productions,
right.
which provides that stability
right.
that you're not getting from the raw employment.
Yes, 100%.
And that's a much larger, bigger discussion.
Yes,
probably.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you were around, obviously, during the hard times, right? You saw a couple of the companies you worked at shut down as well, right? So you saw the
yeah.
suffering that went through that process. You saw Rhythm and Hughes go. You know, Image Movers Digital, and a bunch of other things like that. So was your move to the game industry away from that sort of motivated by like, I don't want, because obviously at that time, I'm assuming you saw the wave of people having to move out of Los Angeles, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, there I wouldn't say that it's the reason,
right.
but it's one of a myriad of reasons.
Sure.
I'm from Los Angeles, born and raised.
Right.
Grew up here. I love Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I've got a fam. I have my own family here.
Right. And you've got extended
family here. Yep. So I'm not really looking to necessarily move away from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Not that I wouldn't for the right opportunity, but it wouldn't be my first choice necessarily.
Sure.
Right around the mid-2000s, mm-hmm. I think we started to have issues in the Los Angeles visual effects industry mm-hmm. that were exacerbated by foreign production subsidies.
Right.
Runaway production.
Sure.
Productions going away from Los Angeles to other cities and states in the U.S. mm-hmm. as well as other countries.
Sure.
So there was a period of time where it seemed like every other week a visual effects studio in Los Angeles was going out of business.
Right.
Things have gotten a lot better in the past few years.
Yeah, because they're not here anymore. there's very few visual effects companies. There are quote unquote headquarters, but not most of the manpower is outside this area.
Yeah, but there also is a lot more production in LA these days as well. From the streaming stuff. I mean, there's more stuff happening.
Sure. Smaller studios are definitely here.
Yeah. Smaller studios are definitely around. Bigger studios have kind of folded up.
Yeah. MPC, all the big ones, MPCs and ILMs and all that stuff. They basically just have offices in all the subsidized areas and barely do much in their unsubsidized area.
So without dwelling on those issues too much, because I could talk about that for a while. That'd be a whole other podcast. You know, you kind of see where the growth industries are happening.
Okay.
And video games is currently a big growth industry.
Oh, yeah.
And
video games, the content, I mean, you remember from your early days playing video games on your Apple TV, video games have gotten extraordinarily sophisticated.
Yeah.
And really amazing stories, too.
Yeah. I mean, video games are absolutely amazing right now. And they're only getting better.
Right.
I've always been a gamer. I've always played games.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, I saw Tron, and Tron is literally about video games.
Yep.
I wanted to make games at points. I programmed my own little AppleSoft basic games and stuff. But I ended up working in visual effects.
Okay.
For however it ended up, that's where I ended up.
Right.
And I always wanted to get into games. But yep. I had a little bit of difficulty breaking in. Into the game world. Yeah,
okay.
I would talk to game companies, and often there would be some concern because, you know, I'm used to long renders and high polygon counts.
Right.
And
are you sure you know this is completely different?
A certain amount of fidelity for feature films, and that I wouldn't be able to operate on the limited polygon budgets and frame rates that are required for video games. I understand that point of view. Mm-hmm. However, I was also very cognizant of those issues. So I never felt like it would have been an issue. I think I would have been fine.
Sure.
But it took a long time to sort of, you know, find a game company that looked at my experience and realized that I really had something to offer in the production of games using the procedural techniques that I'd been honing for many, many years.
Sure.
And Insomniac had a job opening mm-hmm. for a procedural technical artist.
Okay.
And I mean, it was almost like the job description was written for me.
Right.
It was exactly what I was doing at that time, which is, you know, writing pipelines and describing how data was moving around from package to package.
Sure.
You know, if you think of a game engine, it's really another content creation package.
Yes.
So if you can, you know, write tools to shuttle data between Maya and Houdini, it's not that much of a hop, skip, and a jump to get data in and out of a game engine.
Right.
So I left Logan and I joined Insomniac Games.
Oh, that's pretty awesome. Okay, so one of the titles you worked on, which I want to sort of skip ahead a little bit, is I want to talk about Spider-Man, because obviously I think that that game, which is a PS4 exclusive, am I right?
Yes, it's published by Sony, and it is a PS4 exclusive.
And it is really, really interesting, mainly because it's such an interesting concept of the open world stuff, right? Your ability to move around at pretty fast speeds through this massive world. How fast? Just so people describe the game a little bit to people, if you don't mind.
Well, it's you get to play Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Peter Parker as Spider-Man.
Yep.
In our game, it's an original IP, so it's not tied to any specific movie or specific comic book timeline.
Okay.
Peter Parker is a little bit older. He's no longer a high school student.
Okay.
He has kind of graduated college. He's a young adult. Mm-hmm. He's trying to make it in New York City. Mm-hmm. And he's really kind of come into his own as Spider-Man.
Okay.
He's a mature Spider-Man.
Right.
He is in control and in possession of his Spider-Man abilities.
All right.
He's extremely dexterous and can navigate, swing, jump through the city with a sort of fluidity.
Okay.
And high speed.
Right.
So traversal through this open world was a pillar of the game.
Right.
And this open world is, it's Marvel's Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Spider-Man lives in Manhattan. So this is a version of Manhattan, mm-hmm. Marvel's Manhattan. And it's approximately 6 kilometers by 3 kilometers.
Right.
So it's big. Mm-hmm. There are thousands of buildings, city blocks, mm-hmm. full of stuff.
Right.
Street signs, street lights, ATMs, newspaper vending machines.
A lot of stuff.
Traffic, pedestrians.
Right.
All sorts of stuff. It's just chock-a-block full of stuff
right.
that you fly through at about 60 kilometers an hour.
Right.
And it all gets motion blurred.
Wow.
But as soon as you stop and it's not motion blurred,
you see
it's
everything.
All there and you right. see everything.
Right.
But there's this incredible sense of fluidity to Spider-Man's traversal through the city.
Right.
So as you traverse the city, you get quests, you fight crime,
right.
And you follow a single-player narrative story that really, really hits a lot of emotional notes, has a lot of pathos, mm-hmm. and a lot of action. And I don't want to spoil it for anybody in
right.
case they haven't played. But it's really a great story.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think obviously the story is going to be something that everyone needs to experience. But I think the idea of how do you get all this data and how do you traverse through all this data, again, with those restrictions that you mentioned, right? Because it's a video game, so it still has to play at 30 or 60 frames a second, and you still have to be able to do all of that. So how did you manage that?
Well, there are a lot of things going on under the hood.
Right.
Spider-Man is 30 frames a second.
Uh-huh.
On the PlayStation 4, it's high def.
Right.
On the PS4 Pro, it's running 4K
okay.
and HDR.
Yes. More data.
Yeah, more data. And I got to give a ton of credit to our software engineering department. There's some amazing guys there.
Mm-hmm.
They really, really optimize and tune the Insomniac engine
okay.
to be able to deliver this stuff.
Yeah.
So we have a proprietary engine.
Okay.
We're not using
so your own Unity. Your own render.
It's our own game engine
right.
that's rendering all this stuff.
How long has it been around?
That's an interesting question. Insomniac has always had its own game engine.
Okay.
And it has gone through various iterations and rewrites in the 25-year history of the company.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was that old. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, the engine that we have today is obviously
nothing to
do with.
Yeah. The new hardware, new everything.
Yeah. It's new everything.
Yeah.
Spider-Man is what would be considered a streaming game.
Right.
By that, I mean that the data is constantly streaming off the disk.
Right. So you can't actually hold all of that data in RAM.
Well, it's an entire city. It's all of New York.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Yeah.
And there is a version of the city that's in RAM the whole time.
A low poly, low version.
Yeah. It's what we call the imposter version of the city. It's not an imposter in the sense of billboards or 2D. Mm-hmm. It's actually 3D meshes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we call them IG imposters for Insomniac Games imposters. I did a presentation on IG imposters at SIGGRAPH Asia this year.
Oh, nice.
So that's been published. It's out there
in
the world. So there is a low polygon and projected texture mapped version of the entire city that exists in resident memory and takes up, I think off the top of my head, somewhere around 230 megabytes for the geometry and the lowest MIP.
Okay.
And then what happens is as Spider-Man moves through the city, whatever area Spider-Man is in, we load in the high resolution assets for that game area.
Okay.
And when I say a game area, what we do is we take the city of Manhattan and we divide it up into tiles or squares that are 128 meters on a side.
Okay.
And there are approximately 726, I think.
Tiles
that make up the island of Manhattan and Rikers Prison. Each of those tiles contains the high resolution assets for the buildings and content that make up that area.
Right.
As Spider-Man traverses through the city, we load the tile that Spider-Man is currently in, as well as the neighboring eight tiles.
Okay.
So at any given time, there's about eight tiles of high-res assets loaded into memory.
So by the time you get to the next tile, it's already loaded and you can start preloading the ones around that
and one. And if Spider-Man is moving quickly, we generally, we can compute a vector along which he's moving and a frustum.
And predict.
And we can try to do some prediction about what the most likely next thing we're going to need to load is.
Right. So there's a lot of read-write going on.
Well, no, there's no write.
I mean, no, not
it's
right. All read. A lot of read.
It's a lot of read, not a lot of write.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, that's very cool. That's a really cool. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's in a sense, it's not dissimilar from ray tracing where you have to sort of predict where your ray is going to go and say, Nats, load this part of the geometry, right? That's kind of like the way that, you know, BSB tree works in a sense.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yes, there's a lot of predictive stuff happening and you know, splitting things up into areas that you can kind of reason about and load in quickly.
I think it's so great because obviously it just, you know, for something that's on a video console, it just seems, it's really detailed, which is really amazing, but it just seems so fluid because you guys have figured out how to, no one really is conscious of the fact that the rest of the city is not the higher res one.
Not if we've done our jobs.
Yeah. So no one really knows that. It just seems like wherever I go, it's the most detail I've ever seen.
And I mean, there's a lot of things happening under the hood though. Like for example, there's geometric level of detail that's happening. There are texture MIPS that are happening.
Yep.
We also have a dynamic resolution that's happening, which means that we're not always rendering the full 4K frame.
Interesting.
If we detect that we're not keeping up with the frame rate,
which is more important,
which you got to maintain frame rate, we'll actually drop the resolution.
Okay.
Now that usually happens when Spider-Man is moving very fast,
and which is motion blurred.
Motion blurred.
Right.
So the fact that we drop the resolution a bit in order to maintain frame rate, doesn't really impact the visual experience.
I see what you mean that it's a streaming thing, right? The way you're describing it as streaming is like, hey, this is just kind of like Netflix. When your bandwidth goes down, it starts to get a little chunky.
Yeah.
Not that you guys were doing that. I think you guys are just down-resing through the motion blur, which means you probably don't see a difference.
We're not down-resing. We're just rendering at a lower resolution. There's a difference.
Right. There is a difference. You're right. Yeah.
And then as soon as, you know, Spider-Man stops,
then you load everything.
And then we render again at the highest possible quality.
Right.
So there are considerations like that. that are going on all the time. Interesting. Kind of just, it's constantly monitoring its own performance.
Right.
And maintaining a frame rate.
Right.
There's a lot of other data that streams off the disk as well. Now, Spider-Man has real-time global illumination.
Okay.
For example.
He does?
It does. It okay. does have real-time global illumination.
All right.
But it is cached.
It's cached, right.
So it's not being, the global illumination is not being generated at real time.
Right.
What we do is we pre-compute
right.
the global illumination mm-hmm. for three bounces.
Okay.
So, and the way that we do that is we take the entire open world
yeah.
and we grid it up at 1 square meter resolution.
Right.
So for every 1 square meter, okay. there's a point. That point is represented by 6 colors and 6 vectors.
Okay.
It's essentially a single pixel cube map.
Yes. Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
But because it's 6 colors mm-hmm. and a, 6 colors and 6 vectors, mm-hmm. it's highly compressible.
Right.
But you know, for every, for every 16 meters
right.
of space in our open world, there are 4,096 samples.
Right.
Okay. So for every tile, mm-hmm. we split the tile up into 16 meter volumes. Mm-hmm. We do a sort of optimization pass to determine if there's actually any surfaces in those volumes that would react to light.
Right.
We cull out any volumes within that 128 meter yeah. area that don't have any influence.
Right.
And then we sample at a 1 meter resolution the diffuse response for global illumination.
Got it.
In addition to all of the
lighting geometry. Conditions. It's got to be different lighting conditions too.
Oh, yes, there are. There are times of day. So we've got night, we've got sunset, we've right. got day, we've got a rainy time of day. Mm-hmm. So you have a cache for each time one. Of day.
Yeah.
So in addition
so
to...
Much, this got, how much data?
You know...
That's a lot of data.
I cannot give you that figure off the top of my head, but right. there's actually a really, really good GDC talk that was done this year by a fella named Alon Ruskin.
Uh-huh.
So Alon Ruskin did a technical postmortem of Spider-Man.
Wow.
Where he goes into a deep dive about a lot of this stuff.
Right.
And he breaks down for every frame that's rendered, how much time is spent on each of these items.
Right.
It's a really, really fascinating GDC presentation.
Interesting. And, is it online?
It's online. Yeah, awesome. I believe it's part of the free GDC vault.
Okay, so we'll have to find
it. It's out there. Alon Ruskin, Spider-Man, a technical postmortem.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. Well, it's really cool. I think it's a great show. Now, I know that we have to be careful about some of the new stuff you guys are doing. You can't talk about new hardware. You can't talk about any unannounced games or et cetera.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah. Of course.
We do have one game that's coming out for the Oculus Rift called Stormland.
Oh, okay. So that's something that people can look into.
Yeah, that's something that people can look into. We have had demos of Stormland at E3 this year.
Okay.
PAX West, I think, as well.
Nice.
It's a really, really great experience for the Oculus Rift.
Right.
It's an open world adventure game where you get to play a robot who has lost its memory.
Nice.
And you
got to figure out.
Got to figure out your story.
Nice. I love it. Well, that's cool. That's really cool. How are you liking being in games? I think, you know, you said it was like, well, the job just wrote itself for me, but how long have you been there now?
I've been in Insomniac almost 3 years.
Okay.
And I love it.
Really?
Yeah. I absolutely love it. I love the people I'm working with. I love games. I've always loved games.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the fact that I get to make games now, it's awesome.
Right.
I feel like I'm learning new things every day working there.
Yeah.
I'd been in visual effects for quite a while.
Yeah.
And while I still was always learning things, I think the pace at which I was learning things had sort of slowed down a little bit.
I get it.
And so by jumping over to games, I'm being exposed to a whole new set of problems to solve, a whole new set of
knowledge. Well, I think it's
knowledge.
Yeah. I think it's so great because the games now are in their renaissance phase, I think. They're having so much more going on. Stories are getting more complex. Game technology is getting so much more interesting. Obviously, we're heavily involved in figuring out real-time ray tracing, but that's making its way into the game industry right now. I just wrote an article for PlayStation Magazine about how ray tracing is going to change the game world. Jury's still out on that, but they said the same thing about ray tracing in the movies, and now pretty much every movie you see is ray traced.
Well, and the video cards that are going into PCs these days are incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And, they're always only getting more powerful.
Sure, sure. So games are going to start looking a lot closer to movies. They already are, but it's going to be even more so, I think, at this point.
I think you're just, over time, you're just always going to see the visual fidelity increase.
Right.
But at the same time, as an artistic medium, it also allows for non-photorealistic choices to be made as well.
Sure.
If you look at some of the indie games that come out, that really experiment and sort of play with various looks and ways of doing things and even challenge notions of what is perception.
Right.
It's fascinating. There was a game that came out last year called The Curse of the Obra Dinn, which it's a 3D adventure game. But if you look at the graphics, they look like 1-bit Macintosh graphics from 1984. Everything is cross-hatched in black and white.
Oh, wow.
Even though it's texture mapped onto 3D objects.
Right, right, right.
It's a fascinating look.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I think it's cool. And there's so many ideas of like small independent games that are out there. They're creating little things that are really cool for sure.
Yeah, lots of puzzle games.
Yeah.
There's obviously this, Spider-Man is a AAA game. Insomniac is a AAA studio. That's what we do. And we love it. And we're very passionate about what we're doing.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that there's not a whole other, side to games.
Right.
And with the advent of things like Unity and Unreal, the bar to entry is significantly lower than it used to be.
Right.
So it allows for some creativity and experimentation. And some of my favorite games over the past few years have come out of there's a company called That Game Company. And
okay.
It's a Sony. I think they're not involved with Sony really, but I don't want to misspeak. But they've had games like Flower and Journey.
I love Journey.
And there was a game on the PS3 that they did where you played a microbe that was eating other microbes. And Flower was interesting because you're just like, you're the wind and you're blowing flower petals around.
Right.
And if you think about it, the game mechanics actually kind of like Pac-Man because you're really just going around kind of eating dots.
Right.
But the presentation of it is like that you're the wind and you're blowing. And
nice.
It's this very lilting kind of gameplay that...
Yeah.
It was absolutely fantastic.
Well, I think what's also interesting now is how the technology of games the technology that is used to make games is now becoming much more useful beyond games, right? So things like Unreal and Unity are getting into a market that's beyond the games, but they're founded on game technology, right? So
sure, yeah, those tools are being used for pre-visualization in film, and they're being used on mocap stages.
Mocap stages, architecture visualization.
It's really...
car design.
Yeah, the world of real-time graphics is pretty amazing. Even things that aren't necessarily game engines. There's a package called Touch Designer, which is... kind of an offshoot of Houdini, written by one of the founders of Houdini, Greg Hermanovic.
Okay.
And that's been used for all sorts of installation art.
Wow.
And it's used for, VJs use it. I think Deadmau5 actually has a channel where he has tutorials on how to do real-time graphics with Touch Designer.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
I've spoken to him, by the way.
Deadmau5?
Yeah. He's a fast. He loves Houdini. He uses a lot of Houdini.
So he'd be natural for touch. It's a very similar interface.
Yeah, that totally makes sense now. And he does a lot of real-time stuff as well. And he's a really interesting guy. We were talking about stuff with him. I was talking with him it was long story, but he's a really technical CG guy, believe it or not, like beyond all of his music and stuff like that. Really cool. Okay. Well, listen, I don't know if you realize it, but we've been well over an hour. So we've talked about everything, which has been incredible. It's really cool. Obviously, like you said, we can't necessarily talk about things that are not released, but where can people look for news about your company and stuff, obviously?
Well, you can always go to the Insomniac Games webpage,
right,
which is insomniac.games,
okay,
or insomniacgames.com.
Okay.
We always announce things at E3.
Right. I'm sure you guys are on social media and stuff like that.
We're on social media. Right. I mean, we've got a social media team.
Right.
We've got Facebook accounts and Twitter accounts.
Right.
Twitch accounts.
Yeah, Twitch is another big thing that's happened now.
We do, we actually stream games that we play, not even our own games, just like we'll do a retro stream of some game that is somebody's favorite, uh-huh, and do kind of like a live stream and commentary as we play through a game.
That's great.
So we're doing a lot of stuff like that on social media.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, cool. This has been great. Well, thanks so much, X-Ray. It's been a lot of fun to sort of like walk down the history of things that you've done. I think it's fabulous. I also love the fact that you're a California native and LA native, which is such a rare thing in visual effects world. So it sort of really ties things together. But thanks so much for doing this, man.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, Chris. Really great talking to you.